You may know him best as Big Brother Robert Barone on Everybody Loves Raymond, but he's also one of the most popular and familiar voices in many of your favorite animated classics on the big and small screens. He is Brad Garrett. I'm Jerry Strauss, and this is the Laugh Track.
Do you need your weekly comedy fix? Relax while we visit the sitcoms you love, the jokes you remember, the characters you will never forget, and the stars that bring them to you. Sit back. It's the Laugh Track with Jerry Strauss.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the Laugh Track with Jerry Strauss. He is I am him, and you're here. And we're thankful for it. Thank you so much for joining us again this week. We've got a really good classic interview this time out. And what I mean by classic, this is a conversation from a few years ago that I had with, in my opinion, one of the greats of our era in TV comedy. From animated stuff to sitcoms, stand-up comedy. He made his star turn, I guess you could say, as part of that old competition show Star Search back in the 80s. And he just never really looked back, always a part of our lives and our TV consumption and our laughter. Brad Garrett is with us this week. Again, this is from a few years ago. And this goes back to one of our earlier episodes where I had the opportunity to speak to Jason Alexander from Seinfeld. That was for a great magazine I write for called Edge Magazine. You can find them at edgemagonline.com. And I did a big feature, a cover story on Jason at that time. And we said, you know what? This was such a great conversation. If everyone agrees, and Jason was cool with it, everyone was cool with it, let's bring that audio right here to the Laugh Track. Well, we're doing it again. And we're doing it with a classic, as I said, from a few years ago, a story I did for that same magazine, for Edge, with Brad Garrett. And such a great conversation, such a cool history and a great resume that this man has. And it was great to learn all about it. So we're going to revisit that conversation. Lots of great insights on Everybody Loves Raymond, even into his more recent show, Single Parents, that went for a couple of years, much more recently, and other aspects of his amazing career as well. So without further ado, it's Brad Garrett right here on the Laugh Track.
What are you still living at home, Jerry?
Oh, I wish. It'd be a lot less stressful.
Wouldn't it, though?
Sure. Yeah. So we're just kind of going to be all over the place. Thank you for doing this, by the way.
Thank you.
No, okay. You went to UCLA, and from what I read, you didn't stay very long before dropping out.
Yeah. 6 weeks.
Wow. Yeah. So, did you know ahead of time that you were short-lived for that direction, or was it something spontaneous?
You know, it was really pretty spontaneous. I got to college, and I was like, man, I'm way over my head. And it's something I always wanted to do, and, you know, I got accepted into UCLA in the theater department outside of high school, and I was like, man, this is great. And I started doing stand-up at the same time. And I was doing open mic nights, you know, going on at, 11, 12 at night on open mic nights and getting home at all godly hours and then driving to UCLA. And I just was, there was just no way I was going to hack it. Mm-hmm. And that's probably one of my few regrets. I wish I stayed in college, but I was like, man, I'm not ready for this.
Well, you bring up something interesting because you hear so many stories about people starting out on the stand-up scene on the East Coast in New York, et cetera, but you don't hear as much about really starting launching a comedy career on the West Coast. How was it different from your experience? What was the vibe like out there versus what was going on in New York?
You know, it was really very much the same because I went to New York when I was like 18 and I worked some open mic nights there. You know, the bottom line is it's a click. It's a click on the East Coast. Or it's a click on the West Coast. And they were both very, very competitive. And if you were a New York guy, you know, you had to make yourself known in LA and vice versa. But I really was never, I really never hung out. I really, you know, I started around the same time as, you know, Seinfeld and, you know, Larry Miller and Kevin Nealon and all these guys, but I really never hung with them. I got to know them later and, you know, was a huge fan of all of them, of course, but I was never like in that group. You know, I always kind of, was kind of a loner, you know, but it was very much the same type of vibe. I think LA was a little maybe more ahead of New York as far as the evolution of the comics getting paid and, you know, that thing that went down at the Comedy Store. It was a lot more maybe territorial on the West Coast. I mean, if you worked the Comedy Store, you couldn't work the Improv and vice versa. Back East, they really didn't lay the law down like that. You could work Dangerfields and then the Comic Strip and, you know, Catch or whatever. It became a one or the other scenario, which is unfortunate.
So I'm going to lump two things together here because I think they're similar in a lot of ways in that people today may not understand the unbelievable significance of them. But two major points of your early career was A, being on and winning the comedy competition on Star Search, which I'm sure there's a right. lot of kids out there who don't know what Star Search is. And then the second, of course, being sure. on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. So, I mean, we'll go back right. over those two things. How did those two things affect you? Not necessarily the prize money, et cetera, but how did each of them right. instantly affect your career?
Well, you know, Star Search was really, you know, that was 83 I was on it. I was young. I was 23 years old. You had you had a minute and a half of stand-up to do. And that was it. And I was going against guys, to be honest, that were a lot more schooled in stand-up, that have been around a lot longer, and were probably better acts, to be honest. But one thing I did have was my stuff was kind of one-linery and quick, and I did some dead-on impressions back in those days. And when you had a minute and a half, it hit quicker than a guy doing a bit about an airline or his parents or whatever, because 90 seconds is, you know, a ridiculous amount of time to give a stand-up. I mean, your opening is almost your closing. And I got very, very lucky, and, you know, I got to be known for a couple impressions that was like a discovery show, discovery of talent. There had been nothing like that before, except, you know, if you go back 30 years or something. So it really showcased a lot of people. And when I won it, I started opening for some major opening acts in Vegas and Atlantic City and Tahoe. And through that, I got the Tonight Show, I'm sure because of the connection that Ed had. And then I went on the Tonight Show, and I had a decent set. You know, I do a lot of improv. I do a lot of off the audience. And that was really kind of my strength. But back in the day when I was on the Tonight Show, if you had a great set, you know, like a Seinfeld did or a Shanley would, you know, you had a development deal the next day.
Right.
What it gave me was an incredible opportunity to do a stand-up tour, you know, opening for some major acts. And by doing that, I really honed my craft because, you know, when you're an opening act, no one wants to really see you. So you're right. going out in front of thousands of people with nothing but, you know, your ability that you happen to have or not have that night. So by going on the road with these big names, it really was school. It was really, because, you know, when I once started, I was doing stand-up, you know, like 3 years, 4 years. So I didn't have a lot, but going on the road, that really led to a lot of confidence and getting a lot of fearless, you know, fearless opportunities of, you know, you got to be fearless in stand-up. And by going out there in front of these people when no one wants to see you, you know, I came back a different stand-up 3 years later, you know.
There's a really impressive list of talent, of stars that you did open, that you opened for. I mean, I'm looking at the list, Frank Sinatra, David Copperfield, Smokey Robinson, Sammy Davis Jr. It goes on and on. Is there anyone, I mean, they're not comedians, but is there anyone whom you opened for who gave you any sort of advice just about kind of handling an audience or just being a performer?
Well, you know, I think what a lot of it was being able to sit in the wings and watch Sammy Davis Jr., who is maybe the most talented person I had ever seen, maybe to this day, as far as being, you know, they used to call him the triple threat. You know, he could do everything. He could sing, he could dance, he could act. Mm-hmm. You know, he used to do, you know, Phantom had just come out when I was opening for Sammy, and he did this scene from Phantom that was just chilling, you know, and unbelievable. And he was supposed to play the Phantom actually in London before he got sick. And, you know, to sit there and watch Sinatra, you know, with a 22 piece orchestra, even though, you know, I have to admit it was later in his life and, you know, he'd kind of go in and out. I would have to keep introducing myself every other time I would open for him, you know, and he kept calling me Greg Barrett, you know, and I just rolled with it because I didn't have the balls to correct him. You know, it's Frank Sinatra. You don't want to correct him, you know? So, I think it was just, and my mom would say, she would go, why don't you just sit him down and go, Frank, I'm Brad. You know, and I go, yeah, Mom, I'm going to sit Frank down. I'm going to have a sit down with Sinatra. It's going to go over well with Jilly. But I think what it was is I was in a small way around, you know, this part of show business that just doesn't exist anymore. It's very, very different now. And so I think I hopefully learned some showmanship, and they were very welcoming into their world. And, you know, my key was I did my show and I kind of disappeared. And then sometimes they would ask you to hang or go out to dinner, or, you know, Sammy was so incredibly gracious when he would open at a hotel on the strip, he would invite everybody up and down the strip that was an entertainer, whether you were a backup singer or a dancer or a headliner or an opening act. And he'd rent out the local theater in Vegas or Tahoe, and he'd invite everyone that was in the entertainment industry and throw a party. And it was really, you know, it was just so great to be around that, because that era's gone, obviously.
Okay, guys, quick time out here from this fantastic conversation. I'm having a lot of fun, but let's talk about something that is super important. A great organization, No Kid Hungry, is a campaign that is helping kids remain fed each and every day, even when school is not in session. So take a listen to this message and get to know No Kid Hungry.
Because of the coronavirus, schools have closed nationwide, and kids in need are missing nearly 34 million school meals every day. For many, it's the only healthy food they might get in a given day. No Kid Hungry has a plan to feed these kids, but they need your help. Donate now at nokidhungry.org to help feed America's children during this crisis and in the months to come. That's nokidhungry.org. Thanks.
Now, another big part of your careers, I wanted to touch on, of course, is voiceovers, animated features and voices and things. How did you first get into that? That's obviously become one of your giant calling cards.
Well, you know, I started doing voiceovers really in like the early 80s, right around the time I was doing stand-up. And I think a lot of that just came from the impressions I was doing in my stand-up on TV, the different voices, the different ranges. And, you know, I've always had a kind of a voice that, you know, sounded like, you know, a guy vacuuming in a tuba. You know, I've always kind of had this bottom to it. And once I started doing, I started on Saturday morning cartoons, and I was either playing, you know, the wind or a thug or a burglar or, you know, whatever. And that just kind of just led to one thing to another. And, you know, the voiceover business is, it's a small group of guys. And I'm very grateful for what I've done, because there's a handful of brilliant, brilliant guys out there that can do 100 voices and 50 sounds. And I'm limited, you know. So, but I got to work with some great voiceover guys like Jim Cummings, who I just did Winnie the Pooh with. Or Christopher Robin, you know, we were doing, you know, Saturday morning cartoons in the 80s, and I got to know a lot of great guys. But it's just something I'm a huge fan of of animation. And I think when you grow up a lonely kid, you know, you have a lot of imaginary friends, as I still do. And medication is helping that.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. Everybody Loves Raymond. Where did you find inspiration for the character of Robert?
Well, you know, it was funny. I had a fight for that audition. I had trouble. They just didn't see me doing it. Huh. And Ray was like, no, not the guy from Star Search, you know, which I understand. But he was, no one would need the giant, you know. But the minute I read the script, I begged my managers at the time. I said, I know this guy, you know. I just, you know, the writing was so good on that show. And the minute I read it, I just had a very different way of playing it. And they really, you know, they were out to a couple other actors. And I begged to just go read for the creator, Phil Rosenthal. And they wanted like a Danny DeVito type of, you know, little pit bull guy that was always at Ray's heels. You know, the cop brother in real life was shorter than Ray and very jealous in Ray. And even that line, you know, everybody loves Raymond, came out of Ray's life after he won an award for his stand-up. Hmm. And his brother saw the award he got and goes, well, that's great. I just got shot at today, but I guess everybody loves Raymond. So that's how that ended up, that line in the pilot. But I just wanted to play him kind of the opposite of my size, the opposite of what they saw, as a guy that was just, you know, though we did have bursts of anger, mm-hmm. I just wanted to play it. But I owe a lot to the writing, and they knew how to write for this character so well, all the characters. But there's a fine line of, you know, not playing anger in comedy, but playing frustration.
Yeah.
So, you know, they kept Robert frustrated, you know, and in a lot of ways he had the upper hand in some episodes over Raymond, but the family wouldn't allow it. So it was a lot of fun things to play.
You know, we talked about all the different things that you do. Do you still enjoy doing a mix of things all the time? Because now you're on a new show on ABC, but at the same time, you're still touring and doing one-man shows and performing in front of people. Is there something you prefer over the other, or do you just kind of need that variety?
You know, I get bored easily. I'm a little ADD, or a lot ADD. And I just, you know, I'm at the point in my life that I want to do what I love, or I want to do something that I'm really attracted to. Like when I read the pilot for Single Parents, I was like, boy, this Douglas guy, this is a very different character for me. This is something I haven't played on TV. And I was really intrigued. And then when I knew that, you know, Karen Killam was part of it, and I was such a fan of him in SNL, and then I met the guy, and he's just one of the kindest humans. I was like, well, this is a no-brainer. I hope we can make this happen. But I do like the different avenues. You know, I just got done doing I'm Dying Up Here, which was a very dramatic role on the Showtime show that they wrote for me. And it was something that scared me at first. I was like, man, this guy is super dark. I love the role. And I couldn't wait to, you know, very, very grateful that they would write something like that for me, because that doesn't come along for comedic people often. But so I like to, you know, I'm kind of at the point in my life, it's fun to do things I haven't done yet. As far as the stand-up, I'll always go back to that, because that's my first love, and it's something that you really never have down. It's something where it's different every night, mm-hmm. and my act isn't, but the people change, you know.
Yeah. Okay, cool. One more question for you, just going back to Raymond real quick. There's always persistent rumors. Sure. I mean, there's rumors that even, you know, years ago, there was heavy talk about a spinoff for you. What's the speculation? Where would Robert be if there were a spinoff that were going on after, you know, at some point then or now? Where was he headed?
He'd probably be divorced and running from the law at this point. to be real honest with you, you know, he wasn't wrapped that tight. You know, it's funny. We talked about it very early on the last year. We had some great ideas, and we thought it was going to happen, but they couldn't make the deal with, you know, they wanted the same, you know, we all wanted the same writers and obviously the same showrunner because, you know, the magic there was the writing. Mm-hmm. Of course, the cast had a chemistry, which is what's exciting for me about the new show, actually, because we just had this chemistry in the pilot that's very rare. You know, you can only fake it so much, but when you are able to tag on to another person's timing or reaction and it feels natural, which it just did with Single Parents. But there was a lot of moving parts, but I would probably say that, you know, Robert would probably be divorced right now, maybe living with Ray.
We'll put that on Twitter, but without you, we'll separate it.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah. Brad, thank you. We covered everything and we're good. So I appreciate it.
Thanks for your time.
All right. You too.
Thanks for your time.
Bye.
Bye.
Guys, thank you again and again and again for joining us on the Laugh Track. We appreciate you being here. We appreciate you following us and sharing and spreading the word. And we want to keep the ball rolling. The Laugh Track, of course, produced by me, Jerry Strauss, with additional Major League production by our maestro, Steve Prentice, our friend who does all the heavy lifting here on this show. And of course, if you want to hear more of our show, make sure you check out our website. LaughTrackPod.com is your one-stop shop for episodes old and new, as well as our free mailing list and links to all of our social media and many of the outlets where you can hear the show. We're on Apple, we're on Spotify, we are on Google, we're everywhere, man, and you can be too. So make sure you subscribe wherever you'd like so you can get the latest episodes as soon as they are released each and every week. Of course, social media, we're all over it, man. Instagram, we have an account that you can and should follow at Laugh Track Pod. Twitter, follow us there at Laugh Track TV. And of course, our Facebook group is growing and popping off, if you will. Is that what the kids say? You can check us out there and please join us at facebook.com/groups/LaughTrackPod. Until next week, I'm Jerry Strauss. For Steve Prentice, this is the Laugh Track.